Papers, papers, papers. We'll start off with that. I don't know what that's about. Extra points end at the end of the month. And then after that, it's like April 20-something or other, when it must be dropped into engage. So please do not forget. The other thing that I've been mentioning to my classes is, as of this moment, it looks as if only two people are in line to get the perfect attendance bonus. Three, because you had an excused absence. So three people. Yeah, it's a small class. We'll say the three people are in line to possibly get five extra points. If it drops down to two, we'll let them get 7 points. And at that point, we'll let a slugfest ensue. And whoever is the last man or woman standing will get 10 points if there is one left. So, FYI. Now, just so you know, Busra was in the running in one of my classes last semester. She made it almost to the end, and she stumbled when the finish line was in sight. And there was another kid. There was a three-way going similar. And another kid dropped out literally the last day of class. He missed it. So one young lady was left, and she was giddy all the way to the bank, and she ended up getting 10 points. Although, ironically, neither Busra nor the young man, I can't remember his name, nor the young lady, can't remember her name, none of them actually needed the points because they all had A's anyways. But again, it's still something that I can tout. So, FYI.
So who are the other two in this class?
What?
So who are the other two in this class that are...
1, 2, 3. Oh. Sam, Riley, Bush.
Oh, okay.
You were in the running, but you joke! That's an excuse. Although I should give you a credit excuse just for going to Texas, because that's on my bucket list. At some point I'm going to go to Texas. Because everything just seems freer in Texas.
I'll say one thing, though. The food portions are massive.
Yeah.
Like, you'll have like 6 pounds of meat on your plate.
Although I'm going to say I like North Carolina barbecue more than I like Texas barbecue.
I like them both.
Just saying.
I'm not picky. Okay.
Good barbecue is good, no matter what form it comes in.
Exactly.
All right. So, we're talking about the attempt of the Easterners to open up another front in hopes of taking pressure off of Russia. We know that the British decided to target the Ottoman Empire because they were perceived to be the weakest link in the Central Powers. And their goal was to blast their way into the Black Sea, in the belief that if they could open up that waterway, they could then give direct material support to the Russians. But of course, as we know, the Brits were egotistical maniacs, and they believed, just because they were superior in their perspective, that they didn't have to do things like recon to gather intelligence. And they would attempt to force their way through. Only two tragic results. Of course, as I left off with, had they actually gone again, they would have gotten through. Because most of the mines were gone, and as we said, the Turks did not have much left in the way of artillery. So had they been persistent, the whole course of the war could have changed. But instead, they decided to do something that originally they were opposed to after the abysmal failure of the Royal Marines. They decided to put boots on the ground. Now, the plan was straightforward. You land men on the beaches of Gallipoli, and then they could proceed over the mountainous terrain, come over the backside, and begin knocking out the forts. They would also drop a secondary group at Aribernu here, believing that to do the same thing, penetration. But of course, what did they not do?
Recon.
They did not recon. So they had no idea what they were sending their men into. All right, here we go. A April 21st, the first boots on the ground would arrive. The plan, as I said, was to bisect the peninsula and establish secured street staging area. But the terrain itself was positioned so that way you land on the beach and then the hills rise almost to mountainous levels. What do you think the Turks did?
Set up machine gun nests up there?
Yeah, of course. They had positioned men all along the ridges, and they had the advantage of looking downhill with physics. And at the same time as efforts were made to attempt the landing, the Turks are up on the hill and began licking their chops. Fish in a barrel. Because the moment they start, I mean, you can see it in these pictures. Look at the way the hills just rise up right off the beaches. The moment they would get in gun range, and by the way, the Turks had it all marked. They knew exactly what the maximum efficiency of their machine guns were, because they didn't have surplus ammunition. So the minute the British forces went beyond that line, they met a harrowing barrage. So, as a result, the men literally had to crawl. And as they crawled, they were exposed the whole way. Because again, I put pictures on here for a reason. Look at the hills. There's no trees. There's no cover. There's just like rock and scrub. And everywhere where there was a low point in the hills, the Turks had already dug in trenches. So the Brits would come around the corner, and there would be the Turks with the machine guns. The terrain means everything in military operations. To get off the beaches, the Brits needed to climb up the hill, and like I said, the Turks already had it all mapped out. It was all mapped out. All mapped out. So you move 10 feet beyond the beach, and you're dead. For all sakes and purposes. Not literally, figuratively. So why didn't they pull their ships in then and then open up volleys of barrages? Well, again, like I said, the hills were steep and then they went down. Naval guns don't necessarily have the luxury at this time of pinpoint accuracy. They didn't have the gyroscopic mechanisms that were put in prior to World War II. So as the ships went up and down in the water, that impacted the sighting of the guns. So if you shoot too low, you're going to send your rounds and you're going to blast the side of the hill where there's no Turks. Or if the gun's just a little too high, it's going to fly overhead. But to make matters worse, the individual ship captains had full discretion over whether they fired or not. And after the failure of trying to push through the Dardanelles, the majority of the British ship captains were terrified of getting too close to the shore because they didn't know where the Turkish guns were. So if they pull in too close, they could be dead boat walking or sailing. And so the vast majority of the captains, because again, there was no structure of command where the ruling ranking officer could tell everyone what to do. Each of the captain was in charge of his own ship. The vast majority of the captains said, well, too bad. Plus, they really didn't have much munitions to spend randomly trying to blow up a mountain. So instead of doing something, they decided to do nothing. So the machine gun positions had full rein to unleash death. And by the way, the Turks were as efficient with their Maxims as the Germans were, because as we talked about before, the Germans sent officers to train the Turks. So, after the failure of the first attempt to blast out of the beach on April 25th, they continued to send more men, more supplies, and they would attempt a second push off the beach on June 2nd. They literally ordered their men to stand up out of where they were covered and run up. Again, look, no trees, all just scrub brush. And there's a nice picture of the Turks. They must have been laughing. I know, I would have been. It's easy. So as a result, the Brits once again had to turn around and withdraw. But, because of British ego, if at first you don't succeed, try again by repeating the exact same strategy. August 3rd, they would attempt another push after bringing in more men. They told the men not to stop until they get to the top of the hills. Well, because they had no intelligence, they didn't realize that by this point, the Turks had already brought in reinforcements and several shipments of German munitions, artillery rounds, had arrived. So they began opening up their guns, as well as their machine guns. And they literally would rain down death on the British, who would be forced to retreat back down to the beaches. And then complicating things, in the middle of it all, Bulgaria, who up to this point had been neutral, decides to join the war. And this is important because of geography. I told you, the Germans managed to get some rounds in, but the moment Bulgaria came in, you literally had railroads that would run all the way to Constantinople. So soon, train shipment after train shipment were leaving German factories and going down to support the Turks. And then if that wasn't bad enough, Turkey has weather changes. Beginning in November, it started raining violently for 3 weeks, almost nonstop. But then when the rain stopped, cold winds blew in and it turned to snow. And a blizzard hit. So these are guys that barely have enough food, barely have enough fresh water. I can tell you what they did not have. Warm, well, rather cold weather clothing. So soon disease starts breaking out in the British camps. And it would be in the beginning of December that the Brits simply decided they were done. A full withdrawal was ordered. Ironically, out of all of the campaigns associated with Gallipoli, only with the withdrawal was the most success. When the Turks saw that the Brits were pulling out, they didn't open fire. They just let them go. So not a single guy died trying to leave the beaches of Gallipoli. The last boots would leave the beach on January 9th, 1916. A 9-month campaign that was costly. Now in total, each side suffered about 250,000 casualties. On the British side, over 46,000 were killed, and on the Turkish side, 65,000 were killed. Most of the deaths, however, were due to illness. The Brits in particular, because they were literally hiding behind rocks on beaches, they didn't exactly have clean latrines, clean sources of water. So typhoid, dysentery would break out. Diarrhea was a constant way of life. Most historians estimate that close to 110,000 men, 90,000 British, 20,000 French, had to be evacuated just because they were too sick to fight. Now, of course, this was a black eye for the British war machine. It exposed. Wait, how the heck am I on campaign? I should be a click ahead. There we go. It exposed not only that the British High Command was incompetent. Again, let's plan a major invasion with hundreds of thousands of men, multiple naval vessels, and we'll just land at a place based on tourist maps. Well, to make matters worse, this would make London gun-shy. It would be many years before the Brits were willing to take such a risk as they did at Gallipoli, because it was a catastrophic failure. But guess who was blamed? Because you always, if something goes wrong, you're always going to find a scapegoat. Guess who got blamed?
Churchill.
Churchill did. Yeah, it would have made sense. I would have blamed the French just because they're French, but nope. Churchill was blamed. Churchill was targeted by the conservatives. They ran him out of the Admiralty. He would be demoted down to some obscure cabinet position. He would be the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which is the equivalent of like being a mayor. He came from a very noble, prestigious family, and to be demoted as such was enraging. I mean, after all, he had been controlling the entire Royal Navy. Now he's collecting rents. So you know what he does? He did something that I wish our political leaders had the balls to do. He quit. And he joined the army. He would spend 3 months training, and then he would go over at the age of 42 and actually go to the Western Front. He would spend almost 4 months in the trenches, side by side with the common draftees. And he served distinctly. He ended up being pulled out because he got sick. But he would actually be promoted to the rank of lieutenant colonel. Well, when he left, he ran for public office, got elected to parliament, and would be one of the strongest voices in the House of Commons for the soldiers. He not only advocated for full veterans' benefits, but he also managed to marshal through the passage of legislation resulting in the development of the M1916 helmet. Because when he was over there, he saw that the French had helmets. And why did they have helmets? Not because they were bulletproof, but because of all the damn shrapnel. And the Brits didn't have one. So if you ever look at a picture of a British soldier after 1916, by the end of 1916, it would become standard issue. Big, round, circle piece of steel with a little hump pumped in the middle with a visor all around. Looks more like a medieval helmet than a battle helmet. But the whole idea is not only are you giving the soldier a visor, but by putting the shield around, when the shrapnel comes down, it's kind of also protecting like the jugular area as well. So, the veterans, the troops, love this man. And they would do so for the rest of his life. Imagine if Joe Biden did that.
Know where the hell he is half the time.
No, I know. Well, they'll pump him, if there's certain times, they'll pump him up full of drugs like they did for the State of the Union address. So that way the angry Joe Biden comes out.
The right-hand Joe Biden.
Yeah. Nothing I find more pleasurable than having an 81-year-old guy going like,
it's like,
it's like
the
although Trump also shin splints, so he was a draft dodger. All right. So, when Gallipoli failed, there was still some that sought the idea of trying to establish a east southern flank, trying to do something to impact the situation. Dealing with Turkey over here did not work. So what they decided to do is attempt to start a front in the Balkans. And this would give rise to the next campaign, known sometimes as the Greek campaign, although the Greeks themselves refer to it as Salonika. Now, the humiliation with the Dardanelles, that was the result of European hubris. Like I said, they believed that they simply could push around the Turks, that somehow they were just superior and the Turks would just roll over. Been there, did that. And they believed that they could achieve their victory. Just because. And once they achieved that victory, that would cause the Hun, the Germans, to sit down and want to negotiate. Of course, we know pride and fantasy does not win wars. Oh God, I heard a good line the other day. Let's see if I can get it right. When you assume something, and you believe an assumption because you assume, you're making an ass out of you and me. I think I said it right. Well, why the heck did they end up in Greece? Well, that was because of Balkan politics. They decided to exploit the conditions that had been existing in the Balkans for over 100 years. Now, here's the thing. If Gallipoli was successful, I could almost guarantee that Bulgaria, Romania, would have joined the Entente. One of the only reasons why Bulgaria joined the Central Powers is they were sitting back saying, wow, the Turks are kicking the living shit out of the English, and that's not the side I want to be on. I don't want to be on the side of the losers. So, ironically, had events turned a different way, well, there would have been no need for it. But the moment Bulgaria joined with the Central Powers, the German war machine went into operation. Why? Well, you can see it in the yellow. This was the German-Ottoman line. It was a railroad constructed by Germany at the turn of the century. And it was this that allowed the Germans to send train loads of munitions down to their ally. Now, so long as Bulgaria was neutral, the trains could go through. Because Serbia never declared war on Germany, and Germany never declared war on Serbia. So even though the Serbs were fighting against the Austrians, the same wasn't true. So German trains could go through. But the moment Bulgaria came in, well, all we got to do is worry about this a little bit. So, let's help out our Austrian buddies. And by helping out our Austrian buddies, we're going to help out our Ottoman buddies, who now we also can help out the Bulgarians. So, Falkenhayn orders two German armies, newly created armies, to march south from the Eastern Front through Austria-Hungary and invade Serbia. And the goal was to basically conquer all of the Serbian lands through which their railroad ran. Of course, by doing so, they effectively would cripple Serbia. Now, FYI, some of these lands would be given to Bulgaria. Because one of the promises that the Germans made was that we'll give you some Serbian territory and we'll give you some Thracian territory. Just come on in and fight with us. Again, those promises that everybody was making. And so even though Bulgaria had no right or reason to be involved, they were enticed in. All right. Well, here's the truth. The Serbs, as we know, fought valiantly when Austria tried invading in 1914. Ultimately, it was like a pendulum. While Austria did make some advancements, as we know, this advancement was stymied by the outbreak of disease. But the Serbs, while this was going on, contacted the Greeks, and the Greeks were neutral. Now, by the way, interestingly enough, Serbia and Greece had actually signed a treaty in 1913 that was a defensive treaty. And in the treaty, Greece promised to send 150,000 troops into Serbia if Serbia ever called in the need. Well, when the snows of 1915 began to melt, they knew the Austrians were going to come back, so they called in a favor. But rather than following his treaty obligations, the Greek Prime Minister Eleutheros Venizelos decided to replace his troops with Entente troops. Serbia calls him, he calls France and England, and says, hey, you guys are allies with Serbia. Why don't you send in some of your troops to help the Serbs? Now, here's the funny thing. This would allow Greece to remain neutral. And so if the Turks attack the Greeks, that would be a violation of international law. So the Greeks are sitting back saying, we're not going to lose a single guy. We're not going to lose a single dust of gold. We're going to let someone else do it for us. Brilliant. Well, when the Entente got this, they're like, at the time, we're kind of like in the middle of Gallipoli. We're kind of busy. Don't know if we actually should do it, but okay. Because strategically, it did kind of make sense, right? If you use Greece as a landing point and you send sufficient troops, you could essentially drive all the way up through Serbia and begin hitting Austria. And by doing so, you're going to help out the Italians. So it's kind of like a win-win. At least on paper. Right? On paper. Sounds good. But guess what? One, they didn't commit enough men. The Brits would only send 10,000 soldiers. The French would only send 30,000 soldiers. So how are you going to launch this major invasion of Austria-Hungary with 40,000 men? You're not, right? You're not. Oh, there we go. Insufficient. Number two, they kept dragging their feet. Even though they were contacted in the spring of 1915, they didn't deploy a single soldier until October 5th, 2 days after Bulgaria announced they were joining the Central Powers. So this meant for almost an entire year, Serbia's by itself. And let me tell you, the Serbs did not do so well against the Germans. By that point, most of Serbia was overrun. And the moment Bulgaria declared, they sent soldiers in from the east. Oh, the map's gone. So Germany and Austria is coming into Serbia from the north. Bulgaria comes in from the east. There really was not much left of Serbia by the time the first Allied soldier arrived. And as if that wasn't bad enough, the majority of the troops were men who were sick or slightly injured in Gallipoli. The first unit, the 10th Irish, literally all the men that were fit were pulled off the beach, put on a ship, and sailed right over and dropped in Greece. So now what did they have to do? Well, they had to march through Greece because they couldn't stay in Greece, and they had to go into southern Serbia. Well, the problem is the terrain, and the terrain in southern Serbia is mountainous. So to get to where you got to go, you get to cross over. So you've just been on the beaches, getting shot at by the Turks. You get put on a boat, and now you have to go climb mountains. You up for it? Oh, and by the way, remember where I said no winter gear?
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. By November, 20% of the Allied soldiers had to be removed off the lines because of frostbite. Now, there was one battle in December 1914 near the southern Serbian city of Kostura. The Bulgarians had already moved down. And it was minor because the Bulgarians didn't have many troops in the area and the Allies didn't have many troops in the area. And in the end, it was mostly artillery exchanges because neither side had enough men to rush the other's positions. So, what ended up happening was when the Allies ran out of rounds and it looked like the Bulgarians were going to rush them, the Allies simply pulled back into the province of Salonika. And over the next several months, all throughout the winter, they would build a massive fortified position, which became known as the Birdcage. And they're not in Greece, they're in Serbia and part of Albania, but this is where they would remain for about a year and a half. They would actually make kind of like a tent city. Again, there's a view from up on the hill. The guys themselves would have to do the work themselves, and they did their best to hide the position or hide their artillery guns in the position. But again, as you can see by the picture, most of it, same thing. It's just broad, open land. But the Bulgarians did not attack. So, if anything, the second wave of soldiers that were deployed there, they would have a vacation all throughout 1916, and they really wouldn't see any action until midway 1917, when there would be an attempt to retake Serbia. So they were there, not exactly a big southern front, but they were there. Questions? Well, at the same time that was going on, there also was conflict in Africa. Again, this is a world war. Oh, wait, that's blank. That's snow. Africa. A This is what Africa looked like in 1914. Ironically, I just talked about this in my World Civ class. By 1914, just about every square inch of Africa was taken by one of the major European powers. In the reds and pinks, you have the British. In the blues, you have the French. In the grays, you have the Germans. The green are the Portuguese. The light purples are the Belgians. The light green are the Italians. And of course, you have a minor Spanish presence. But again, a lot of desert out here. Nobody really wanted it. A lot of desert here. Nobody really wanted it. But the bulk of it is completely taken over. And it's in one of several versions of what we could consider colonies. Although technically they weren't all colonies. There were some that were protectorates, where the allies would put like a puppet on the throne, and the puppet would do the bidding of the European power. There were some territories that were actually colonies, and there were some that just kind of ruled like spheres of influences. So the allied nation would have control over the, like what happened in Morocco. We talked about that. What happened in Morocco with the French. All right. Now, ironically, when the war broke out, it provided opportunity to the Brits, who wanted almost a complete monopolistic control over southern and eastern Africa. Oh, and if they could squeeze the Germans out of here as well, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Because where was the German Navy? In comparison to the British Navy?
All concentrated in Europe.
Like the North Sea.
Yes.
Why were they like concentrated in the North Sea?
The blockade.
So if the enemy can't get to their colonies, how are they going to send more men? How are they going to send more munitions? We're going to take them. Why? Well, because they can. Sorry, no offense. If I was to walk by your house and your door was wide open, and then I went by tomorrow and the door was wide open, and I went by the following day and the door was wide open, guess what I would eventually do? I'd go inside and I'd help myself. Because if the door's open and no one's home, finders keepers, losers weepers. But here's the kick. We talked about this. Remember when the Berlin Conference was called by Bismarck? And the 14 great powers, Germany, Austria, Russia, Britain, France, Belgium, Denmark, Spain, America, Italy, Netherlands, Portugal, Sweden, the Ottoman Empire, they all gathered together and they all decided to make international law. They made the rules on how they were going to deal with Africa. Why? Well, remember, when Bismarck was chancellor, he didn't want colonies. He thought colonies were stupid. He thought they were a waste of money, materiel. His focus was preserving German unification. But he also didn't want a war to be sparked in Africa that could break out in Europe. Because after all, by the 1870s, 1880s, the English, who hate the French, are plunging in. The Belgians are there. The Spanish are there. You have all these nations jumping in, and all it would take is one to accidentally shoot at the other, and you could have a catastrophe that could erupt in a war in Europe. Why did Bismarck think this? He knew his history. Have you ever heard of the Seven Years' War?
I have. I just don't remember entirely.
Hold on. We got a smirk. Where did the Seven Years' War begin?
It wasn't Africa, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, I think
Yeah, you're thinking way too. Yeah. So the Seven Years' War erupted in 1756, and it ended in 1763.
Yeah, Prussia was still around, and they were fighting the Russians, I'm pretty sure, weren't they?
The Austrians.
The Austrians, excuse me. Shit.
It happened in America.
No. It did start in America.
Yeah, it was British colonies were looking to expand into French and indigenous territory.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm stupid. I know exactly.
Yeah, the French and Indian War.
Yeah, the French and Indian War. And who started the French and Indian War?
Wasn't it the British?
No.
Well, kind of.
It was the colonists.
No, I want a name.
You're losing your name.
Oh, you were doing so well. You were doing so well, too. It was George Washington.
I was thinking it was George Washington, but I just didn't want to say it.
George Washington, when he traveled out to the modern city of Pittsburgh, and when he arrived, the French had a fort called Fort Duquesne, and he opened fire on them because the French were not supposed to be there because it was English territory. So the war started here, and it ended up erupting in Europe.
So wait, if it was the French and the Brits fighting, then why did the Prussians end up fighting the Austrians?
Because the Austrians and the Prussians had beef, so a proxy war on the continent was fought.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was so confused. I was like, wait a minute, why did they fight again?
Yeah, it was just messed up. But Bismarck knew his history, and he realized, okay, Europeans have a tendency to do stupid things. So if they start fighting one another in Africa, a war could erupt in Europe, which he did not want. Remember? That's the reason why he was doing all the alliances, and he was holding the hands of everyone to prevent war. So he gathers this conference just for that. And what did they agree to? The rules under international law on how Africa would be carved up. And these rules are known as, if you recall, I think we covered this back for the first exam, the principles of effective occupation. I would ask if anyone remembered it, but I'm glad that we got two guys that made the connection with where I was going. That was good. In order to possess land, so no one else can come in and take it from you, so it's your territory, you had to have possession, you had to have a treaty with the local leaders, you had to have the right to fly your flag there, so you had the right to occupy buildings and embassies and so forth, and you had the right to administer. You had some type of administrative authority. So you could tell the locals what to do. So all of that map had been created based on those four principles. So in other words, what's yours is yours. You have a right to it, so long as you do those four things. Now, by the way, also in the treaty was a specific clause that all nations would agree that Africa would be neutral ground. So in other words, if a war erupted, it wouldn't spread. Or if a war started somewhere else, it would not spread to Africa. So basically, what happens in Africa stays in Africa. So what ended up happening was, is instead of fighting a war over a river or a mountain range, the European powers would just negotiate. And again, I wish I had an old map. If you look online, there's a map of what Africa looked like in the 1880s, and they were just small little dots. But by 1914, it had turned into that. Through negotiations, all of the little dots were expanded. You give me your land, I'll give you yours. I'm going to take possession over here. I'm going to get a bigger domain. You take possession over here. And the end result was almost the entire continent was controlled. But under international law, what happens there stays there. And what happens elsewhere doesn't go there. So even though World War I erupted in Europe, under international law, those colonies are Germany's. And no one is supposed to mess with it. But you know who never listened to international law?
The Brits.
They didn't care. the Brits, the shining beacon of liberty prior to America. They were some of the biggest hypocrites around. Because what did the Brits want? Empire. So, the Brits, all throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, would only follow international law when it was convenient. But the moment it was inconvenient, what, there's no rules. So what does this mean? Well, the Brits and the French would soon be able to pretty much roll over Africa and do whatever they wanted. They had numerical superiority, they had well-established military and political presences, and they had access to the seas, which the Germans did not. But there was a problem. Even though they were friends, because remember, that's what the Entente Cordiale was about. It wasn't about an alliance, it was a gentleman's agreement. And when push came to shove, London and Paris did not trust each other. Because what happens if, say, France takes over this German territory? Well, that means the English doesn't get it. And what happens if the English take it over? Well, that means the French don't get it. Well, what about here? Look, it's sandwiched and surrounded. Same thing. What if the English take it? Well, the French don't, and vice versa. So do you really trust your friends? Would you leave a stack of 20s on your desk when your roommate came in? And then you're just going to go take a shower and trust that that stack's going to be there? Would you?
I mean, my friends, I would.
You sure?
Yeah,
did you bet your life on it? That's what I thought.
I don't exactly make friends with people I think would snake me.
Yeah, well, I didn't think so either, but you'd be surprised, particularly when a lot of stock cash is on the line.
I mean, they know what will happen if they steal from me, though. So.
Well, guess what ended up happening to my buddy?
Oh.
Yeah, that was the last time I broke one of my knuckles on his head. All right, but anyways, now we have this problem. So, whenever one moved, the other would move to try to counter that movement out of fear that one would get the upper hand. Now, the only exception was Togoland. Togoland, this little slice right here, went shockingly smooth. And the French and the English actually coordinated their efforts, and they would divide the land for the most part equally once it was taken, which was kind of shocking. Now, one of the reasons why they decided to focus on Togoland was simple. The Germans had a massive radio station there that had the ability to transmit orders into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It was one of the most powerful radio towers in the whole continent. So with this device, they could communicate with the few German ships that actually were in the Atlantic before the blockade went into effect. And they also could communicate with the submarines once they were unleashed. Well, because it was sandwiched between the British colony of the Gold Coast and the French colony of Dahomey, four companies of native troops led by British officers and another four companies of mostly Senegalese troops led by the French invaded Togoland on both sides. And the way it ended up working out, they met in the middle, just outside the town where the radio tower was, and the Germans surrendered pretty much without firing a single shot. And that took them a whole whopping 19 days. No casualties reported. It was piece of cake. But unfortunately, that was the only easy colony that the Allies were able to take. Because elsewhere, the Germans put up a much stiffer fight. For instance, in the Cameroons, right there, a three-way invasion occurred where you had the Brits coming in, you had the French coming in, and you had the Belgians coming in. The problem was is the Cameroons had hostile territory and a ruthless climate. It's like just south of the equator. Average temperatures, 90-something degrees, and humidity that would cause you to your clothes to become moist the moment you walk out the door. So, when the Brits and the Belgians and the Africans invaded, A, they didn't have many troops, and B, they really didn't know where they were going, and C, most of them were colonial troops that were not well trained. But they invaded against an army of 6,000 German troops. And by the way, Germany took possession of Cameroon after the Moroccan crisis, and for the previous 4 years, the most effective military trainers had been there and training up their native army. The local force lasted until February 1916, 2 years of constant fighting. And in the end, in proportion to the armies, casualties were shocking. Again, 9,000 Allied troops, of which 6,500 would either die or would be injured or would become ill. Because you know what was also rampant in Cameroon? Malaria. Of the 6,000, about 5,000 Germans would suffer similarly. So it's not so much that the Allies beat the Germans, it's just that the Germans just kind of said, fine, we're done. But imagine that. 2 years of struggle to take over one tiny little colony. But that's the conditions that were in Africa. Now in the South, you had another interesting scenario. Because just 15 years before, the Afrikaners, the Boers, had fought the Second War of Independence against the Brits. And they almost won. So in order for the British to take the southern territory, right there, of German Southwest Africa, they had to rely upon the Afrikaners, the Boers. Now, when contacted, the leader of South Africa, Louis Botha, who was the military commander of the Boers, basically sat back and said, yeah, we like this opportunity. He promised that his troops could be counted on to defend South Africa from German incursion. This was great because the Brits had no extra troops to send to them. And they basically said to the South Africans, you take them out. To which Botha said, fine. So to do so, we're here now. Christ, where are we? Here. There we go. So to do so, he implements a draft. And he forms what became known as the South African Defense Force, SADF. And these troops would be used to march into German Southwest Africa. Any of you ever study American history in the 1960s? Or how about in the 1860s? That was another time draft was implemented. How did things turn out?
Wasn't good.
No, it wasn't. You know, New York almost seceded and joined the Confederacy when Lincoln implemented a draft to fight. So, do you know that? They don't usually talk about that. You know that?
No.
Yeah, they usually don't talk about that because it was just the South that would know. New Yorkers said, "We don't want to die for this. We're going to die for ending slavery or whatever."
Yes. Not a lot of people really talk about the war. People want to say it was a war of slavery, which it was, but the South, they weren't represented fairly. They weren't. The taxes were ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, well, the North was just kind of pushing for it. Abraham Lincoln wanted to preserve the Union. That's why he didn't want to go to war.
Right, but Abraham Lincoln was also pro-increased tariff,
yeah,
which is ultimately what caused South Africa to secede, South Carolina, to secede in 1860, once he became president.
Yeah, so it was a war of just trade, and that's why England and France were going to get involved until Abraham Lincoln changed the meaning of the war to now it's a war of emancipation.
Which,
so,
right, the English and the French wanted nothing to do with.
Yep.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Very complicated. It's all right. Politics.
How about the Americans in the 1960s?
They didn't want to go and fight and die in a war in Vietnam. Mm. But not only that, the media...
Oh, they completely used propaganda. Yeah, it was all spun. Yeah,
it was all spun. When they came home, the hippies were calling them baby killers and awful, awful shit that they didn't deserve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially after watching a lot of your friends get killed in a hole in the middle of the jungle.
Although, interestingly enough, there was a poll that was taken by the VA in 2010 or 2015 in which 85% of Vietnam vets said that if they had to go back and do it again, they would do it the same way. Which I find ironic. So who's protesting the war? It was all the hippies.
Yeah.
Who was willing to go over and fight? It was the men who either volunteered or were drafted.
Exactly.
And you know what was also exaggerated? The amount of people that fled to Canada. They make it sound like there's hundreds of thousands of people. No, it was actually only about 10,000. So it was all propaganda. It was all lies. You can't trust anything.
Nope, the people who fled are cowards.
Well, here's the thing. All these guys that were drafted to fight scratched their head and said, wait a minute, we were just fighting against the English. Now we're going to fight for the English? What do we get out of the deal? So a rebellion of massive proportion would erupt in South Africa when the Boers decide we want nothing to do with it. One of the biggest revolts took place in the Orange River Colony and Transvaal. Over 12,000 Boers took up arms against their government. They would rather strike against their government than die for a government who sold them out. But unfortunately, the weapons that the Boers had were the same weapons that their fathers and their grandfathers had. Late 1880s, single shot or limited bolt action. Not as effective as the Maxim machine guns that the British gave to the South African government. And unfortunately, the government unleashed a hail of bullets and killed many of their own people to crush the rebellion. But once the Boers were crushed, then Botha would lead an army of 50,000 into South Africa. Now, by the way, this little blurb took 7 months. But with this army, it would take him probably be about to July. The Germans really didn't have many soldiers in Southwest Africa. So for the most part, it was just a matter of going in and occupying cities. And once they had occupied enough, the German government simply surrendered. And South Africa would occupy the territory. Kind of boring, but it's important. Oh, I hope we have enough time to get through this one. Because out of all of what was taken in Africa, place in Africa, this is my favorite. Oh, I got to stay focused. Focus, Lomatic. Be eye on the game. Eye on the game. We can do this. No tangents. No talking about George Washington, although he is the father of our country. All right. Challenges. Definitely challenges. But the hardest challenge took place in East Africa. Because facing off against the Entente was a figure that maybe about 30 years ago you might have learned in American history. You don't learn about it anymore. Or rather, world history. Lieutenant Colonel Paul von Leto Vorbeck. He would command an army of about 14,000. He had about 3,000 German soldiers, but he had 11,000 Askari warriors who he trained in the European tradition, and he learned from them the African tradition of warfare. So his army literally was an army of special forces, trained to fight conventionally and in guerrilla tactics. And his troops loved him. He lived with them. He knew, I think I read, all of their names. Imagine trying to remember the names of 14,000 people, but he knew them all. He ate with them, he slept with them, he marched with them. He was one of them. And he would build a highly mobile insurgent force. Now, when war was declared, he let his presence be known. In August, after he heard of what happened in Togoland, he would lead his army unannounced and would invade what technically then was the East Africa Protectorate, although today we call it Kenya. He marched in. He caused havoc and destruction. But his goal was not to conquer, but rather to make noise. Because the Brits were terrified. Because Italy technically was an ally of Germany at the time. And you're pretty close to the Red Sea when you get up here. And what's going through the Red Sea?
The Suez Canal.
Oh, the Suez Canal. So all of the British merchant vessels. If he could expand his control, he could possibly shut down the Suez Canal. So not only would that stop the merchant ships, but you know what England was planning on doing? Taking a whole bunch of Indian soldiers, the sepoys, and using them to go fight wars. So, let out Vorbeck's plan. Let's make a whole bunch of noise here so the British have to commit soldiers here instead of going to the Western Front. You attack the enemy by drawing their resources away. And man, it scared the shit out of the British. So in November, by November, they began transporting a huge force of Indian soldiers into Kenya with a plan of marching in and seizing the only major port in Germany's Africa, Tanga. Well, like the British had a tendency to do, they didn't do any recon, they didn't do any intelligence, they had no idea how big of an army that Letal Vorbeck commanded, and he completely decimated the English soldier, I mean the Indian soldiers. There was about 14,000. Killed about 3,000, captured another 4,000, and causing the rest to retreat. He, throughout the next several weeks and months, seemed to be everywhere. And why? Well, here's the key. He had complete control over Lake Tanganyika. Now, Tanganyika is the second deepest, second largest freshwater lake on Earth. It shares the border with four modern African countries, Tanzania and Congo, making up about 85% of the shoreline. Shortly after the war began, the Germans would have naval superiority over the lake. And they did so with only three vessels. The largest of which is the famous Graf Gotzen. Any of you see the movie The African Queen with Humphrey Bogart? No? Or read the book? I was going to ask you if you read the book, but I know nobody reads the book. You read the book?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah.
The Graf Gotzen was the bad boat in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you know what I'm talking about. That's good. That's good. Well, the only ships that were in the lake were Belgian small ships and the Graf Gotzen, along with two smaller vessels, the Kingani and the Hedwig, basically sunk everything and had complete military control over the lake. And so, Letal Vorbeck would use the lake to ferry men anywhere he needed to go. Now, that's not to say that the Brits didn't try to do something about it. They did. As time went on, they began committing more and more and more men, more and more resources. And it would take them time. Now, ironically, one of the first things they focused on was dealing with the lake. So, what did they do? Well, the boats are down here. I don't know if you can see them too well. These are two tiny armored motorboats. One of them's called the Mimi, and the other one's called the Tutau. They put the boats on a train and they transported them to Albertville, which is located on the western shore down here. And once they dropped the boats in under the cover of darkness, they would only sail the boats out when they surveyed in the distance and they couldn't see any of the German ships, because they did not want them to be discovered. But thanks to intel, they discovered where the German ships docked. But they would not strike until December 1915, when they launched a surprise attack and they managed to capture the Kingani and they sunk the Hedwig, because they had a big mortar on the front of the gun, of boat. Boosh, boosh, boosh. Leaving only the Gotzen in control of the lake. Well, once they were down to one boat, the Brits then began move. Oh, it should be right where this little nub is. It's probably going to come up on the next click. Kingomana. This was the primary German military base of operations on the lake. So what did the Brits do? Well, they came up from the south, unbeknownst to Lettow Vorbeck, and they managed to capture the port. And once they captured the port, that made it very difficult to fuel the Godsen. Simultaneously, the Belgians from Congo began building up military positions. They brought in some artillery guns in hopes of being able to knock the Godsen out of the water. And they brought in planes. And as late as June 1916, they tried doing some bombing runs on the Godsen. Because after all, the boat, when it's in the middle of the lake, it's kind of a sitting target. But something happened in July. The Godsen sunk. Now, the Brits claimed that they hit it with a bomb. But the Germans claimed they scuttled the ship because they no longer had fuel to power it. Regardless, the boat was sunk. I'm inclined to believe the German position because the Germans managed to remove all the artillery off the boat. So, you know, if the boat's going to get hit and kind of get blown up, it usually goes down with the guns. You don't have time to dismantle them. But nonetheless, it sunk. And it stayed half sunk in the water until 1926, when it was then raised and purchased by a Kenyan shipping company. And by the way, today, it's called the Lemba, and it's still sailing on the lake to this day, carrying men and supplies across to the four corners of the lake. So if you ever go to Tanzania or Congo or Kenya, you'd have the ability to possibly get a ride on a historically significant ship. And by the way, it's the last World War I era vessel still in operation today. He's late. Oh, I gotta finish. All right. Well, once the lake was secured, they did try relying upon intelligence. They tried locking him down because there was rumors that he had moved his base of operations to Deborah. And the Brits and the Belgians managed to penetrate. But by the time they got there, he was gone. He retreated into the forest, blending in with nature. And amazingly, he disappeared. It was as if the jungle ate him. He managed, however, from 1916 all the way until 1917 to avoid detection. Needless to say, the Allies were quite frustrated. But rumors soon began spreading that maybe he died of malaria. But then, like the boogeyman, after being gone for more than a year, he suddenly reappears in December of 1917, and he attacks the Portuguese colony of Portuguese East Africa. Don't know how the heck he made it through all of these Allied colonies, but somehow he did. And then once he struck, he retreated once again into the jungles. And he would be gone almost for another year until he appeared in northern Rhodesia. Where's the dot? I can't see it. It's got to be on the map. I put it on the map. Oh, there it is, right there. Right down there. He appears here. He marches into the city of Kazama. Actually captures the city. But here's the funny thing. It was November 13th, 1918. What took place just 2 days before?
Armistice.
The armistice. So he goes in, he captures the city, he demands surrender of the British agent, General Jacob von Deventer, who then had the pleasure of telling Letal Vorbeck, there's an armistice. He didn't believe it initially. He somehow had access to wireless communicator, sends message to Berlin, gets it confirmed, and then he willingly says, okay, then we'll have a ceasefire. Now, by the way, the site where he agreed to it, it's a shrine that's still there today. It's called the Kembeshi Monument. Sorry, Josh. I know this bores you. And today, even today, German soldiers learn about him. He's kind of like a Patton figure. Yes, controversial. But ultimately, definitely celebrated. His exploits have been shown in movies and in theaters. And keep in mind, he was the only military commander who controlled an army that never was defeated once in the entire war. So he was definitely revered. Oh, one last other thing. I know we're over. He was alive until the 1960s. The Nazis tried using him in propaganda. He would show up, but he never joined the Nazi party. He simply sat back and said, I'm too old, and old men don't get involved in politics. But which is amazing, because the Nazis kind of exploited most of the other German historical figures. But he lived through it all, and he survived. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to see what happened in the Pacific. And then we're going to talk about the one and only major naval battle of the entire war.